Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Hello everyone, and welcome back to Politics. When we were originally sketching out this season, we had planned about 10 episodes looking at various aspects of AI. The technology, the narratives and political projects behind it, and the real harms being done. We naively imagined that we would be able to cover all of this in a single season. As we started recording the episodes, it felt like events were unfolding at an even faster pace than before, and the list of episodes we wanted to do kept growing. A few weeks ago, we realized that we needed to draw a line somewhere and wrap up season one of the podcast, then take some time to catch our breath and start planning season two. So the next episode will be the season one finale, and it's going to be a good one. We have special guest Brian Merchant joining us to zoom out and look at the big picture of where we are now and what we can do to continue to resist. That episode will come out 2 weeks from now, and in the meantime, we wanted to share a bonus episode with you. Our original theme for season one wasn't actually about AI at all. But about a year ago, Ray and I went to the Heart of Closure conference in Belgium and saw an amazing keynote called From Hype to Responsibility: What Works and What Matters for Whom in Data and AI, delivered by social scientist and researcher Anna Kollum. After the talk, we realized that we needed to change our plans for season one and focus on AI. We connected with Anna for an interview exploring the themes from her talk, and that's the interview we want to share with you right now. Enjoy, and see you in 2 weeks for the season finale.
Of course. Hello, and first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to your podcast. So yeah, my name's Anna, as you said, and I'm a researcher working at the intersections of democratic processes and digital technologies, and more specifically in the last few years in data and AI. I have a bit of a background in deliberative processes and other type of democratic innovations and how they intersect with technologies. So currently I'm working at the Data Tank, which is a nonprofit that's focusing on how we can take a more responsible approach to reusing data so that it can help improve people's lives. And prior to that, I was at the Ada Lovelace Institute, which is a research institute based in London that also does research to ensure that AI is working for people and society.
Great stuff. So Anna, I'm wondering what your connection is to this conference and how you got invited.
It's a good question. I also asked myself, because as I am not a programmer, and actually I did not know about closure language before I was invited. So yeah, it's a good question to ask. I think that the organizers were looking for a talk that brought a bit of a critical lens to the conversation and could zoom out a bit from the technology into more the political, the social, and the philosophical implications. So yeah, it was actually Fran Bennett, who was the former director at the Ada Lovelace Institute, who connected me with the organization. And yeah, I'm so glad I could make it, because we don't really get a chance to talk and converse across disciplines. But I think it's key, and I mentioned that in the talk as well, we do need to work collaborative more and more. So yeah, I was delighted to be able to be there.
Yeah, and I think like as technologists, like we really need to hear this message, because I think we sometimes can fall into the trap of like, I've got an interesting technical problem in front of me. I'm going to solve it. I have no idea what this thing is going to be used for, and I'd rather not know. So I think that message, like with me, it landed so well.
Yeah, I think on that note, just to sort of follow up a little bit, is that I think in technology, there's technologists have kind of long had this like dividing point where they say, oh, you know, I will or will not work for military software. You know, I won't do like missile guidance systems or you know, some people will, some people won't. It's a fairly sharp dividing line, I think. You know, those kind of ethical considerations are, they're felt in the developer community. But I feel like this kind of discussion about like the ethical, the ethics of AI, the ethics of what we're doing as technologists is still buried quite, you know, deep in just like you say, algorithmic considerations, or is this an interesting problem? So yeah, I mean, that was really an interesting thing for me, Anna, about your work and your talks were about zooming out and thinking about, well, what's the purpose of this stuff and what's the context we're operating in? So yeah. Maybe you could give us a quick recap. We don't want to go through the talk and really to get all the points, obviously. the stuff is streaming on YouTube, so you know, all the kind of stuff, and we'll drop a link to that talk in the show notes. But if you could just give us a quick recap of the major points, that would be great, and then we can take it from there.
Yeah, exactly. And as you were saying, I think a key point was that today it doesn't work anymore, not to think that you're working on a narrow problem that you can just focus on that and not worry so much about the other connections. You know, today writing a line of code can have many implications because we live in such a datafied society that, you know, the data you use and the assumptions you make or others make on your behalf on, you know, what's the equation or what are the variables that you are including in an algorithm can really have huge implications beyond whether a pipeline is working or not. So I think that was a key message I was hoping to give. And yeah, overall, the objective for me was to step away from this kind of, I think, a haze of hype that we're going through. And maybe now we're getting out of it, perhaps, hopefully. But I think this is kind of clouding or has been clouding our knowledge and our attitudes towards AI. So I was hoping we could have a more grounded conversations on, you know, data-driven systems, cut through the narratives that serve certain powers very well. And for that, I had to focus quite a bit on current risks and harms. And I worried that maybe gave a pessimistic tone to the talk, but I thought we had to do that so that then we can focus on the positives, no? So we know what is it that we need to avoid. So I went through some of the current risks that we've seen in society, largely related to using algorithms to make decisions related to social services, which have had huge implications. I gave a few examples from the UK, the Netherlands, and Australia on, you know, subsidies, child care benefits, and algorithms used in decisions related to who gets a mortgage or not, who gets a loan or not, and the huge harm that they caused. But then I focused a little bit towards the second half on more constructive pathways for the way forward. So I hope that also was received because I do think that, you know, there's potential, and therefore if we put our energy in this potential, then we'll make a better use of these technologies.
Yeah, absolutely. And that did come through very well on that. And I think just to jump off one of your points that you made, you said like you hope it didn't come across as pessimistic. Like, honestly, I hope it did, because that is the reality we're living in. And one of the things I feel is, you know, you mentioned a kind of hype bubble. You know, I just wanted to kind of point out the fact that AI itself, artificial intelligence, is a very broad marketing term. There are many, many different technologies that fall under that broad umbrella, you know, everything from machine learning models that are very tightly focused on a specific problem, like finding the optimal route to deliver freight or something. Mm-hmm. Now what we're seeing is large language models, which can be used to both understand unstructured text like human language, but also generate it. We should be worried about what are the risks, or what are the harms, rather, that AI is resulting in right now, because there are very real, you know, negative social impacts, you know, some of which you pointed out. So when we say AI, I think as technologists, we need to be very clear about what we mean by that and, you know, what the applications actually are. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, what do you think we should think about when we hear the word AI? Like, how would you like people to think about it?
I think forget about robots and sci-fi, even if, you know, they are a part of it. But the real harms, as you were saying, are about water consumption, energy consumption, how they are worsening our hopes and, you know, to reduce emissions on the one hand. And then the societal harms that we're discussing about, you know, how, for example, algorithms include prejudices and biases in the data, and therefore can be used to make decisions that can have really serious consequences for people being able to access social services, jobs, etc. So I guess we should think about AI as a system of technologies that currently they use vast amounts of data. It's true that they are doing impressive things that we had not seen before, but they are ultimately technologies designed, developed, and applied and made sense of and evaluated by people, by humans. So therefore, they are not neutral. They are not intelligent in the sense that, you know, they can make safe and objective decisions. So we just need to look at it as a tool that can be used for good or bad, depending on how us as people use it.
So one, on following up from that, Anna, is in like classical, like technological breakthroughs, like gene modeling and CRISPR, stuff like this, embryonic technologies, biology, all those kind of things. One sees a kind of this feeling that people are becoming God, mm-hmm. and that somehow there's a sort of reaction against that, and regulators and governments generally get together and decide that there should be some limits imposed on the application of those technologies, and even some limits imposed on the research. These are broad, you know, societal problems that you and your organization are trying to address. What kind of things, or how do you think society and the world should respond to the implications that AI is being used for potentially problematic things, you know, that where people can be harmed, or where the technology itself is, regardless of all this, you know, it's going to destroy all human beings. I don't think that's reality. But no. The current situation,
maybe, but not in the way we think.
Yeah. Pardon me?
I said maybe it will, but not for the reasons everybody's afraid of.
Okay, maybe, yeah. But Given the situation that we have, and like you say, there are fairly glaring problems with the technology, modular the energy use, you know, the actual mm-hmm. application of this thing. How do you think we should respond, and maybe, you know, talk about some of the tools we have as a society to respond to the situation we see in front of us with AI? Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, I think one key thing that I mentioned is, of course, regulation. The problem is that the technology is advancing at such a pace that governments are struggling to keep up, but they are. We now have a EU AI Act, which is not perfect, but it's yeah. something. and it's identifying high risk uses and putting mechanisms in place to mitigate them. But we also need a lot more processes of accountability, evaluation, auditing, throughout the life cycle of the technology, even at the initial stage of, you know, asking the question, what problem do we want to solve with this technology? Mm-hmm. Who is involved in asking this question, and who's involved in the design? So another thing I mentioned in the talk is public participation. And sometimes there's a reaction to that, you know, like, oh, the public don't know, it's too complex to explain. But I think we've now have enough evidence from fields like deliberative democracy, for example, yeah. which consists of bringing together representative mini-publics, so randomly selected groups mm-hmm. of people representative of a society to first learn about a topic, then deliberate, converse, and make recommendations about, you know, how something should be used for what. So public participation, I think, is key. And we, in my previous role at the Ada Lovelace Institute, we did a review of all the, well, not all, but kind of a review of the literature that we were able to identify through our research that related to public participation. And people also want to be involved. It's not enough to do a survey or to just be consulted. They want to be part of decision-making processes. And people do understand and have quite nuanced views about the technology once they learned and have a chance to really be involved meaningfully about it. So I think that that's really important as well.
How do you think we make companies accept that there are other stakeholders beyond their shareholders and investors? Mm-hmm. I think that's a crucial question to me, because it feels like we can talk to at the side about public participation and government regulation, but how do we stop like people like Sam Altman, for example, from essentially just going his own way and not respecting any of this democratic, the sort of institutions and processes that you're talking about? I'm not trying to be too pessimistic either, but I hope that there are ways around this.
Yeah, it is.
But I think it's an interesting, it's the elephant in the room, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So, of course, there's the side of enforcement, and you can, for example, in the procurement processes, have clauses that require that a technology has gone through this process before it can be purchased by a local authority, for example, and has gone through a series of testing and assessments, etc. Then there's the culture, then there's the within the organization's kind of movements. Isabel Ferreres, who's a professor at UC Leuven University, has done work on the democratization of companies and organizations. And of course, we all know it's not easy. It's a lot of power that's held in these companies, but that's another avenue. Workers, I guess, mobilizing and reclaiming their kind of rights and ethics in how they do their work. And I guess then it's also helping organizations understand beyond enforcement the benefits of including people. I know this may sound a bit naive, but there are movements and work done by different organizations. I was, for example, part of a task force led by PAI, Partnership on AI, based in the US, that brought together a lot of people from different countries to put together some guidelines for private sector workers on, what tools are available to that are not radical, but, just ways to embed participation in the design and the development of technologies. So it's many fronts, I guess. There's no like one way. There's also conversations about, for example, having a global people's assembly on data and AI. There was one on climate and environment three years ago. And now there's been a few conversations on doing that. So there's both, a lot has to come from the demand side, I guess, and as well from enforcement.
Yeah. And you've mentioned the word democracy a few times, and I mean, we got to go into what that word means, right? Because I think all too often when people hear the word democracy, they think of, our kind of standard parliamentary or representative liberal democracy, where it's like, if I get to vote, then we have democracy. And I think we really need to reclaim that word. And, in the closure community, we have a tradition of defining words. I'm going to do a little etymology here. And democracy comes from two Greek words. One is demos, which means people, and the other is kratos, I believe. Greek listeners will be mad at my pronunciation. But interestingly, kratos does not mean rule necessarily. That's one of the things it can mean. But it can also mean force or power. And so, like, to me, democracy is the power of the people. And that doesn't mean only elected representatives. That doesn't mean, as both of you pointed to, the C-suite of a company or the board of directors or, Sam Altman, or other kind of Elon Musk, these industrial titans, if you will. So, like, what does democracy actually mean to you? Because you kind of mentioned democracy in the workplace. You mentioned these people's assemblies. So, like, how do we get real democracy?
Wow. Yeah. Of course, that's a huge question. But yeah, I think you're right that we've reached a point where it is clear to many people, definitely people working in academia in these fields, as well as many practitioners, activists, civil society organizations, that representative democracy is just one type of democracy. It might be the least worse, but it's still not good enough, especially in today's world. The problems we have are too complex and too interlinked. And we know that the interests that are driving political parties are not working to solve this complexity. For example, with the climate crisis, there has to be decisions and policies that are quite radical in terms of how people move, for example, around a city, or just changes that we just have to make if we want to meet our targets for zero emissions. But they are so radical and they are difficult to explain that so often politicians don't dare to take them. There's also, of course, lots of interest and lobbies from industries that have a big role to play. But yeah, these kind of 4 or 5 year cycles don't work because politicians want to just stay for the next cycle and rather not implement something that might mean they're kicked out. So yeah, deliberative democracy is a type of democracy that is really now quite common. We're going through what someone called a deliberative wave. So lots of governments, local authorities and civil society trying to implement these approaches. So for me, democracy is really about that, how we together can make informed, deliberative decisions about what societies we want and how they should be governed. And it means also doing it in ways that are inclusive, because we know a lot of people can vote or don't vote. And there's many reasons why sectors of society are left out of so-called democracy. But yeah, we can also apply that to how decisions are made in private companies, in organizations. So you can talk about democracy in terms of how we govern ourselves in a country or in a region or in a village. But you can also talk about it in terms of how we make decisions in organizations.
I think that's a great point, actually, because it feels to me, at least, that we see this, that there's a democracy in certain types of companies in the sense that there's a sort of shareholder democracy. There's, investors have shares in the company, and depending on how many shares they have, they vote on board appointments or, compensation packages, etc. So there is some sort of democracy in the corporate world, but clearly there are other stakeholders in corporations. You know, the people where the technology, the technology affects the public or whoever the technology is used by, as well as the workers who produce the goods and services that a company makes. So I feel like one of the things that we want to talk about in politics is that obligation by the tech workers in these spaces. And it feels to me like they're a crucial player in this world where they're actually doing the work, they're producing the algorithms, they're doing all the data processing. And I would like to see those people involved more and organized more to understand what the implications of their work are. And what has your think tank or your organization done anything about worker organization or what the implications of that could be?
At the moment, I'm at the data tank, and no, we don't focus on this. The mission of the organization is a bit more specific in terms of how data can be reused. And in terms of the human aspect, we do focus a big part of our work is on data stewardship and the role of data stewards in organizations. So, we kind of, we do focus a lot on the human aspect of who's going to be a custodian or a steward of this data and enable this collaboration so that data can be reused responsibly. So we definitely think that building the human infrastructure is key, but we haven't focused so much on the aspect of workers' rights.
Yeah, but I think that point on data stewardship is a really important one, right? Because that you're talking about, I assume you're talking about data stewardship, both kind of on the regulatory level, but also like inside these organizations and companies that are producing and analyzing the data, right? So I'm just thinking, back to our conversation earlier in the Organizing Tech series, where we talked to Per from the Swedish Association of Natural Scientists, and he talked about the role the union has to play in pushing back against or combating discrimination, both gender and race discrimination. And I think that part of organizing workers is often overlooked, that it goes beyond making sure to secure our own working conditions, but also we need to think about, solidarity means that we are standing together for the good of all people. And I think like educating ourselves as tech workers on what responsible use and reuse, as you said, of data is, that is so vital. And then we need to use, our organizations to promote these social goods. I think that, again, like going back to what we were saying, we as tech workers often don't think about what the code we're writing will be used for and what that means for the world. And I'm just wondering on a like, we've talked a bit about the risks, but I think in your talk, you highlighted what, 7 or 8 risks. Can you just pull out, either walk us through them quickly or just pull out the ones that you feel like you really want to highlight?
Sure, of course. Yeah. I can go through them briefly. So for example, yeah. I started talking about the impact of AI-driven systems on rights, human rights, and democratic integrity. Talked about how the risk that these technologies compromise the information environment. Also subverting public consultation processes. We've seen some governments saying that they are consulting the public because basically they are scraping social media and saying that they know what the public wants, which is just the opposite of public participation. Right. You're actually surveying and drawing your own conclusions. The impact on electoral processes and how it's impacting the political discourses. We see more and more power concentration and increasing inequality. So that all has consequences in terms of our democracies. Then I talked about the climate emergency and the huge amounts of water and emissions that data centers and running these technologies requires, and how actually not only big tech companies have already acknowledged that they are not going to meet their targets in terms of emissions, actually there was an article maybe a month ago now that even the numbers that we had available are really underestimated.
Yeah.
So it's not looking good. And what I was saying is maybe, there's ways that we can use AI-driven technologies to protect biodiversity to help mitigate the climate crisis. But at the moment, I'm not seeing enough of how this is possible. So, if it's possible, then we should put our energies there.
Yeah. Just on that point, sorry, about like how we're underestimating the energy and water consumption. One really interesting thing I heard is that in these computations of kind of carbon emissions and energy needs, one thing that's missing from that, we just do not have data from NVIDIA, which is the maker of microchips that are powering all of these, the actual hardware that's being used for these machine learning systems and large language models. They just do not produce their data on energy use and carbon impact on the manufacture of those. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. But sorry, I derailed you a little bit there.
No, exactly. That's the thing. We are also lacking a lot of data and information about ways to really calculate accurately the scale of these impacts. Yeah. Another impact I mentioned, which we talked about earlier, is about economic and social inequalities. And that's, related to what I was mentioning on, for example, decisions on who gets a mortgage, who gets a loan, who gets a job, and how decisions and data that's biased play a role in that. For example, I was just reading an article yesterday about a new research study that has found that some of these AI systems are really discriminatory in terms of advising giving higher interest rates for Black applicants to home mortgages because they were labeled, Black and Hispanic borrowers were labeled as riskier. So this is just an example of many prejudices that are playing.
It's an automated redlining.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then bias and discrimination is, of course, related to that, you know, and what data goes in these systems, how, where it comes from, what languages are included.
Right.
I talked about the work of Joy Bulamwini, yes. Who's done, very important research on, for example, how some systems do not recognize, for example, black faces, just something as basic as that. So,
she has a really great video, right, where she does kind of the spoken word or poem, like demonstrating this. That was very powerful.
Yes, she's an artist as well as a researcher. And I agree. It was so powerful. So I think, the website is poetofcode.com if anyone wants to check it out.
Joy is amazing, yeah.
I also talked a bit about the risk to our human identity, agency, and autonomy, and just asking, encouraging everyone to ask the question of what it means when our relationships are more and more mediated by these systems. For example, in the research we've done with the public at the Ada Lovelace Institute and other research that we synthesized through a review of the literature with it, people are not necessarily negative about different AI uses, but they do worry that some applications, for example, in healthcare or in other important aspects like the delivery of social services, that they will lose the human touch, the ability to explain themselves, and the nuance behind everyone's context and case. What are the implications for that? And then I talked about geopolitics and colonialism.
Definitely unwrap that a tiny bit, please.
Well, I, for example, quoted Keoni Mahelona, who's the chief technology officer of Tehiku Media, who's doing a lot of interesting work using AI and technology in very positive, I would say, and interesting ways to revive and make sure that the Maori language is represented and it's used in a way that's co-owned by the community. And he has this sentence that says, data is the last frontier of colonization. Mm. Because if we think about the type of data, the language of this data that's used, where the power and these companies are located, it's really one-sided. Like, it's very homogeneous in terms of how much the world is represented. So that's something. And then I attended a very interesting talk by some academics from different countries in Africa. It was South Africa, Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria, I think. And they were talking about different philosophies that are quite common in different African contexts. One that we hear more about in Western countries, Ubuntu philosophy. But it's not the only one. But it's this idea that we are people because of how we relate to each other. So it's looking at the individual as relational to everyone else. So it puts a lot more emphasis on community rather than the individual. And they were saying, first of all, these systems are threatening these worldviews because they are encouraging very individual engagements mediated through technology. But they were also saying that actually they could be used to inform how we govern and regulate these technologies, or how we design them in a way that center the collective and social justice and how we relate to each other. So, we can learn a lot from other parts of the world, but at the moment, the trend as led by big tech companies does not really allow for that, as well as, how workers in countries like Kenya are doing a lot of the data labeling in conditions that are just not acceptable in terms of workers' rights. So, there's a few aspects to that.
Yeah, we were speaking a little bit about data stewardship, to go back to the risks again. What about the sort of, you were talking about like the provenance or the inability to answer questions about, why does the AI think like this, or why does it, what are its sources for coming up with a particular answer? Does the data stewardship part also talk about the gathering of data, the sort, you know, the kind of non-consensual gathering of data from the public, but also from artists, from authors, and other sort of creators.
Yes, exactly. This is an area that we are also developing. The Data Tank is a very new organization, but we are definitely looking into the implications of data stewardship and data reuse in the context of AI and the new technologies that, as you say, are just gathering vast amounts of data from anywhere without, you know, any concerns about, you know, whether they are licensed, whether they are open, whether there's any permission from those who might be holding that data to for it to be used. So yes, data stewardship in the context of AI also means a responsible use in terms of, do we know where the data comes from? How has it been gathered? With what we call a social license, you know, what type of permissions or collective consent or public participation in the process. So this is, AI is definitely pushing the boundaries of maybe what the social contract was about, what was open data, what was not, what could be used.
Because I've heard that if people were fairly compensated for the data that AI companies have collected, that it would become, you know, apart from it's uneconomical on its face with the hardware and like energy investments, given the lack of benefits that we see in the world in general, you know, economic benefits, I mean, then if people were forced to be compensated, or if the companies were forced to compensate data owners, then it would also make it even less economical, which to me is not like a squeal from the company saying, oh, you're preventing us from like doing our business. It's like, yeah, well, yes, we are preventing it because it's incorrect. It's unethical. It's you're literally stealing content and not fairly compensating people. So it feels like the business model of stealing data is not sustainable.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm trying to think about, like, in terms, again, about, like, what the, like I said at the beginning, about whether we feel like military technology is an ethical thing or not. You know, how do we feel about the fact that we're making business, that we're doing business on essentially stolen data and stolen property?
Yeah. And just, like, really quickly on that, Ray, like, even without compensating people for the data that you're using in these systems. There was just a paper like a month or two ago by this left-wing think tank called Goldman Sachs. And they basically said, look, this will never be profitable. Like, how is this going to generate a profit? Like, how is this ever going to generate return on investment? So I think even if we even if we play into this neoliberal idea that corporations exist to maximize profit for their shareholders, and that's their only responsibility, they're not even behaving responsibly in that. So, you know, but let's definitely follow the thread of like this idea of, you know, how data stewardship in terms of, well, there were two kind of phrases you use that I'm hoping you can explain a little more. So one was data labeling, and the second one was data reuse. Can you kind of explain what you mean by those two? Because those feel like kind of technical terms of academic research, perhaps.
In terms of data labeling, maybe that's not the right word. It's in terms of how, the one that's actually used in the context of tagging the data so that, you know, like, okay, that's going to be woman, that's going to be man, that's going to be dog. So that the tagging is very important, I understand. I have no technical background, but in developing these systems and a lot of this work, is being done at the moment, but a lot of people based in countries where maybe there's less regulation or some big tech think they can pay less or outsource and pretend that they don't know what's happening.
Isn't the labeling in that case, Anna, just to sort of jump in a little bit, is that it's about whether it's like safe for the public. So those workers are subjected to watching child pornography.
Yeah.
All those kind of like the worst things on the internet that is meant to be essentially kind of like you would imagine the AI should filter it out. But in fact, these people are the ones that are doing all that sort of traumatic work to support the safety of the technology.
Yeah, and it's a, sorry, Anna, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say for AI to be able to filter it, it needs to learn what's what. So I think that's where the tagging comes in. Yeah.
And the really interesting thing, so OpenAI, of course, the company behind ChatGPT, it turns out they have two large language models. So one is the LLM ChatGPT itself, and the other one is the filtering mechanism. So they have a separate machine learning algorithm that governs the filtering. And that's exactly as Ray was talking about there. And as you said, Anna, having human beings look at the output of the unfiltered ChatGPT to label what is safe, unsafe. So, horrible and very exploitative in terms of like who is actually doing this work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the other end, data reuse in the way that I was referring to it and the way we refer to it at the data tank is in a positive way. So we think that there is a lot of potential of using data responsibly, sustainably for informing policies, understanding, for example, how can we move better, more sustainably within a city or, improving our biodiversity. There's so many potential uses. So, we kind of want to reclaim data and reuse it so that it can benefit all of us rather than just specific interests. So that's what I meant by reuse. And that's where the data steward comes in every organization, which is about partnerships. A lot of it is about understanding where's the supply of data, where's the demand of data, and how can we collaborate to make sure that this data can be reused responsibly.
Yeah, I mean, I think to be honest, I could probably go on a whinge fest with you. you're talking a lot of tremendous amount of sense, and I think this is fantastic. We could just carry on. I mean, I could complain about AI all day, but I think the other aspect of your talk, which was light relief, and we should bring that around, I think, at the end of this conversation, is that potentially there are some positive impacts from the technology. You know, if we, in the same way that people say, gamble responsibly, drink responsibly, maybe we use data responsibly as well, So maybe you can talk to that a little bit, Anna, about how we can how we can use this in a more positive manner to get better outcomes for the public.
Yes, I think for me, as far as I understand, considering, my non-technical background, is that narrower models that use data, that we know what the quality of this data is, where it comes from, can also be used to target very specific problems. And I think that's where most of the potential is. I mean, we've just had the news last week that the Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to David Baker from University of Washington, as well as to people from Google DeepMind. But what they did is used and developed an AI model to solve what it seems was a very old problem, which was our capacity to predict proteins' complex structures.
Right.
And it seems this discovery has enormous potential in, can neutralize viruses, target cancer cells.
Right.
So I think uses in medicine, in advancing science, and hopefully helping also in our environment. I think that's where I see the most potential. But the common denominator, I think, is that these models have very high quality data. Yeah. We know what data, we know where it comes from, and we can explain, the process and the model. So I would say these are,
So that's data provenance, I guess, is the word we usually use to talk about, like knowing where the data came from and its quality and so on.
Exactly.
One super interesting thing you just said on that, and this is why I push back so hard against the umbrella term AI. What you just said is like the best uses of quote unquote AI are on very narrow targeted models. So all of the things you just said, I believe large language models cannot do. I mean, they are, as Emily Bender said, stochastic parrots, right? All they do is predict what comes next, or like I said, extract information from natural language. So they can't do things like, you know, understand protein folding, right? Or understand how to most efficiently generate and distribute energy. They just can't do it.
Yeah, and interestingly, these models are the ones that I think have played a big role in this hype that we were talking about at the beginning, because I think they entered the public sphere and everyone's been amazed that, you know, some of these systems can help them, I don't know, answer questions they have at work or or use them as browsers, as searchers. But the thing is, they are not... They can't really, because you can't really trust the answers. So that's
no, exactly.
That's a fundamental problem. Yeah, that you can't. Yeah. The hallucinations are a fundamental problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to optimism.
Yeah. Somebody also described them as a party trick, a really, really, really impressive party trick. But that's all it is.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So yeah, I think that is potential. But as you say, we need to differentiate the type of models and how they are fed, what data they are fed with, etc. Yeah.
So Anna, I realize we've been going on for nearly an hour here, and as Ray said, like, I wish we could do an 8-hour interview with you and just talk all day, you know, but I think both you and our listeners may you know, find that a bit tiring. So if we kind of move toward the end, I really want to give you the last word, and you know, if you can speak directly to technologists, which I hope you're doing on this podcast, I think our audience would largely be people who are working in the technology sector. If you could have them just take one lesson from this interview or one lesson from your work, like, what do you want us as tech workers to do?
I don't know if I'll be able to sum it in one thing, but let me try. I think it's that there is power in all of us making sure that we use data and AI systems in constructive ways. That a line of code might seem inoffensive, but, you know, actually it can embed prejudices in the data. It can embed opinions, or to frame it positively, it can maybe do the opposite, enable more positive, constructive, and collective outcomes and ways of engaging. So yeah, I hope that people don't feel like pessimistic and apathetical about, you know, the discussion, but on the contrary, that yeah, there's power now in every one of us, because we live in such a connected and complex world that the only way forward for me is collaboration and all of us playing a role in our little kind of bubbles, but yet, you know, having to be connected.
Wow. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
So yeah, Anna, again, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure that listeners are also going to be, you know, both educated and also hopefully motivated to take this action that you're asking of us. So thank you so much again. And I hope to speak to you again. You're always welcome to talk to us about whatever you want.
Thank you so much. I had a really good time. And it's very important also for people like me in the social sciences to be able to converse with different disciplines. So I really, really enjoyed that. Thanks.
Likewise.
All right. Have a wonderful day, Anna, Ray, and everyone listening.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky, and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!